But yeah, I got awarded the double bass, and I've got to say it was a big disappointment at first because it was nothing like the harp. You know, I was part of this incredible program at the Australian National Academy of Music where it was called a performance program. So basically you're doing chamber music and solo recitals and orchestra pretty much every day. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Wish we had some more of that here.
Oh, and you know, they pay you. Like, you get paid to study there. Yeah, so you can just make that your full-time job and always putting on recitals. And I played so much chamber music that one year that I was there. It was really amazing. I had someone ask me recently, and this is a professional violinist, can you do double stops on the double bass? Like, can you play two strings at once? And I was like, come on. I mean, probably no. But sometimes it's out of tune.
Welcome to another episode of Artist Room. Now we have finally the name. This is the first episode we record. We have decided on the name and on the format and everything. And this is though a big, big tryout for me. We do the first episode via Zoom because there's so many awesome musicians all around the world that I want to talk to that just, you know, maybe live a bit too far away for us to travel there. And today's guest, Phoebe Russell, is, well, pretty much at the other end of the world, but somebody I have been wanting to talk to for a long time, and we have never met before this, and she was so kind in all the messages I wrote, even though we don't know each other yet. We have talked now for about half an hour trying to set all the technical stuff up, which was not so easy, but I think we managed. We'll see afterwards. Phoebe, thank you so, so much for taking the time. Maybe at the beginning, in case there's some people who don't know you, I mean, all bassists know you, but maybe some non-bassists are watching. I hope they are. Can you introduce yourself real quick?
Yes. So firstly, it's such a pleasure to be here talking to you and meeting for the first time. And I'm hoping that everything works out with the technical issues and all those sorts of things. My name's Phoebe Russell, and I'm principal double bass in Queensland, Australia. And also very passionate about playing a lot of solo and chamber music. And I've been a big fan of Dominic's for a long time. So it's very exciting to meet you all and meet Dominic in person.
Almost in person. I hope one day, like actually in person, because I'm also a huge fan. I told you already earlier, I listened to a lot of your recordings. I think you have an incredibly beautiful sound. And I love that besides the orchestra, yeah, you often do great solo projects, like, you know, premiere new bass concertos, which is so, so important. Listen to those recordings as well, of course. And that's what we need now in the bass world for it to move forward. But before we get to all that stuff, I always like to start at the beginning. Like in your case, you grew up in Australia. What gave you the idea to learn the bass? Is there a bass scene there, a big one? I mean, you are now the bass scene there. But before you, how did you get the idea?
Well, actually, I was really lucky in school that we had a string program where everyone got to learn a string instrument in grade 2. So I would have been about 7 or 8 years old. And I really, really loved the harp. I thought it was the most beautiful, elegant instrument. And as an 8-year-old girl, I loved the gold swirls and the beautiful spirals and all the decoration. And so I came very confidently to the class and I said, could I please play the harp? Unfortunately, they didn't have a harp and that wasn't what they considered a stringed instrument. But they told me the double bass is very similar. It's also very big.
Yeah, it's so also hard to transport.
it's also a nightmare to carry around. So maybe you'd be interested in that. And so I, I really strongly pursued getting to play the double bass, which meant having an arm wrestle with two of the boys in my class, having to tell them that my parents drove at that time a station wagon. I won the arm wrestle somehow. Wow. I think these days, probably at 30 years old, I wouldn't have won. but yeah, I got awarded the double bass, and I've got to say it was a big disappointment at first because it was nothing like the harp.
No, that will chop out like and put at the beginning of the podcast. You know, the bass was a big disappointment at first.
Well, it grew on me clearly because here we are today, 22 years later.
Lucky for us. Lucky for us, you won the arm wrestler. You know, it's often these like little things, like coincidences, you know, like in Bottesini's case, that there was just a scholarship for the bass, you know, and then those are the people who become the leading bassists later.
So true. Bottesini, what a story.
Yeah, and so, but then, so you started at 8 already with the bass then.
Yeah, so I was already playing piano since I was very young. That was my main instrument through school. And then as a kind of a surprise, I applied for a scholarship for high school and I played the double bass for part of the audition and also the piano. And then they awarded me a full scholarship on double bass. And so I was kind of like, oh, I guess this is something that I'm quite good at. And so I'll continue with it. And then I had a really, really amazing teacher who just had so much love for the double bass and played so beautifully. His name is Damien Eckersley, and he was in the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra at the time. And he was so supportive of me. Everything that I wanted to do, he kind of just said, great, so you'll do that, you know. So he gave me...
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it gave me a lot of confidence as well. And that was probably what really... He was definitely the reason that I continued playing bass and continued putting myself out there. And then I actually dropped out of school when I was 15 and went to study with him at the academy in Melbourne. And then not long after that, I moved to Germany.
We'll definitely get to that. Yeah. That is a very interesting chapter for me. But before, you know, I hope it's not going to be too boring for the non-bassist, but I have to ask some bass nerd stuff. What did you learn there? Was it French bow, German bow? Was there a certain system in place? Like what was going on back then in Australia?
So I started on French bow, which I think at the time was very common. But we have both systems in Australia, but both probably equally as common. And then actually I had some issues with my thumb from holding. I'm sure I had terrible technique, but from holding the French bow. And so my teacher, who I switched to, was a German bow player. And he said, why don't you try playing with a German bow? And immediately it was just so much easier. And I find it so much easier. So,
You switch from the wrong to the correct bow grip. Let's. Okay, big disclaimer, this is not serious. Don't, just to be sure that I offend no bassists. It's a joke, yeah. Because, you know, sometimes I say things or post things and people actually take them seriously. So I want to make sure. I think both can be fantastic.
But both can be fantastic, but German bow is more fantastic.
Oh, awesome.
Kidding.
That we will chop out as well and put in the beginning. No, great. So then you switch to the German bow and you actually stopped school. Like, that's a thing many people do. And I, especially, you know, in Germany, you can also start immediately at university after, I think you have to be like until 15, 16 in high school. And then I didn't stop because I'm a crazy person. I'm sure if I had stopped, I would have only practiced all day long and not have seen any people anymore. And I think in my case, you know, it's not like I remember all the stuff I learned in maths or in chemistry from the last years, but the social component for me, since I'm not the most normal person, it was a very healthy thing, but maybe you were a more social person. How was it for you to drop out at that age? How was socializing at the university immediately? How did that feel?
Well, I'm like you as well. I'm a pretty social person. I need that. I tend to lock myself away, and after days, then I wonder why I'm feeling a little bit strange. And that's, yeah, it's always the same reason. But so I dropped out of school, and then a few months later, I started at the academy. So I was surrounded by much older people, but formed some really great connections. So it wasn't like I was just sitting in my room at home. You know, I was part of this incredible program at the Australian National Academy of Music, where it was called a performance program. So basically, you're doing chamber music and solo recitals and orchestra pretty much every day. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Wish we had some more of that here.
Oh, and you know, they pay you. Like, you get paid to study there. Yeah, so you can just make that your full-time job and always putting on recitals. And I played so much chamber music that one year that I was there. It was really amazing.
That's impressive. So it's part of the program that you are supposed to play concerts. Like they push that forward and they even pay you for it as part of your studies.
Yeah, so it's a professional performance program, I think is the name. And most people do that after they finish their bachelor. But there are also some people that do it earlier. And basically you get to, play, perform. And they even send you around. Like I got to play concertos with professional orchestras, part of competitions, but, and I got to do like full hour long recitals, which was amazing when I was 16, because wow. I think otherwise, I may not have had that opportunity.
That's incredible because, I mean, we will continue in progress with your life soon, but here I want to quickly jump in and talk about this a bit more because, when I teach and also when I think about my time studying, I think it's one thing to have a good teacher, to practice well, but to have actual performance experience is so important and it teaches you so, so much. And I think you can only get so far by practicing and this experience of what actually works live. And also of communicating with an audience and through that making actual music, not just trying to play okay. I think that is so incredibly valuable. And in so many schools, it's not part of the program and it doesn't get encouraged. So the fact that you had that at such a young age, that's incredible. Maybe that's also part of the reason why things turned out so well.
Well, I think I didn't realize how good it was, which I think is quite common when you live in a country like Australia that's quite isolated. I mean, obviously, I really enjoyed every moment, but then I was desperate to go overseas and I wanted to, audition for orchestra academies. And like I had all these future plans. And now that I look back, I'm like, wow, I was so fortunate. I make all my students audition for this academy because I think it's just such an amazing thing that Australia has.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. And so you stayed there for like 1 year or how long?
Yeah, so I stayed there for 1 year and then went over to take my auditions in Germany shortly after.
Why Germany?
Well, I just really thought, I read about the Karajan Academy and I thought that would be really cool to play with the Berlin Phil. And probably I wouldn't have expected that it would work, except for my teacher, like I said, was so supportive. And I said, hi, I've read about this academy in the Berlin Philharmonic. And he was like, great, well, go and do it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I just flew over and I had some lessons with some of the section. And
Okay. Before the audition, you had some lessons.
For a few months, actually. Yeah.
Because that's what I thought. I know Berlin Phil, especially, it's an incredible orchestra, incredible bass group. But a very specific style. So it's for me, it's always baffling if people that have not studied there or at least learned the school get in. So, but you have just worked for a few months and then you did the audition and it worked out.
Well, so I went over there to have some lessons for a couple of weeks in, I think it was February. And then one of the teachers said, why don't you just stay here? You may as well, stay here and prepare longer for the audition. And so I prepared from February until May and literally, like you were saying, literally was in a room practicing like 12 hours every day. Like it was unhealthy. I didn't go outside for days on end, just trying to, like you said, emulate everything they did and going to the Berlin Phil every weekend. Like I got completely obsessed and watching the other academists, like at the time it was Vis de Bueve and Under Perino, and they're both amazing bass players.
Yeah,
great friends.
Yeah.
I thought you would. But so I kind of obsessively listened to their YouTube videos as well. And I haven't told them this actually. If they hear this, then yeah. Those couple of months, that's when I really obsessed about the Berlin style and sound.
You know, sometimes this being obsessive with stuff can be so helpful. Like I remember when I was about 13, 14, that's when I got serious with the bass. Before I was, was a hobby. Because back then, when I was that age, I found YouTube and I found the great recordings that are there. Rotaru, Jeff Bradetich, Ibrahimov. And in my case, the first big bass love was Erickson Ruiz, actually. And I listened to his recording in this how he, you know, treated the bass, not just like hit the bass, but he hugged the bass. He would be so sensitive to the strings, and the sound was gorgeous. And I emulated that a lot back then, and that helped me grow so much. And I'm so thankful for it. I actually only met him once and told him that he's one of my biggest bass heroes. he's also nice, totally nice guy. And you actually played with him on the same music stand in the orchestra, right?
Oh yeah, I know Erickson well, and I'm the same. Like, I look up to him so much because I feel like he's someone that you hear his playing on a CD or whatever, and you know exactly who it is. Like,
yes.
Already at such a young age, he developed his own sound, like so lyrical and expressive. And I was really, like, for me, that was the most exciting thing, was my first week with Bell and Phil. I got to sit with Erickson, and I was Ooh. Very, very starstruck.
First week immediately yeah. next to him.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And before you did the audition, who did you study with there? Like, which bassist did you work with?
Well, actually, I had lessons with all of the three principals there. I tracked them down. and so, yeah, I had a few months, and I really had the opportunity to have lessons with each of them.
And later, when you won the Academy, I of course I prepared for this interview, so I listened to some of your other conversations online. You also got to work with Klaus Stoll, I heard.
Yes. He's just I always say he's the father of double bass, I think, in Germany.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's important for the non-bassists. Yeah, he was. How long was he principal bass in Berlin Phil? I don't know, like 40 years or something.
Decades. Yeah, maybe. And he was in the section, I think, before he got the principal job. I'm not entirely sure, but he played there a very long time. And I mean, he's just the grandfather or the father of double bass. And he happened to be a friend of my husband's, who's Bernardo Alves. He's also a double bass player. And
great composer.
Yes. And so Bernardo met Klaus in Mexico when him and his wife Ophelia were there doing classes, and Klaus was the reason that he moved to Germany. Sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. But basically, we had Klaus is a big presence in our lives, and he was a really great mentor and supporter and incredible, incredible teacher. So that was really amazing.
And when you went to Berlin, did you only audition for the Karajan Academy or also for the university there?
Yeah, so I auditioned for Karajan Academy, and then I auditioned for Hans Eisler at the same time.
Ah, and did you then do both? Did you also study at the university at the same time?
Yeah, so I started at Hans Eisler, and I lasted. It got really tricky because I was first year bachelor and also in the Karajan Academy, where I was playing every week a full time schedule.
Yeah,
and I was basically not passing because my German wasn't very good yet, Like, I would sit in history class and I had no idea what they were saying. And I it would come time to submit the assignment, and I just didn't want to admit that I had no idea what had been going on for the last 3 months. So basically, I failed my first semester. So I took an Urlaub semester. Like, I took, like, a semester off, and then I took another one off. And then actually, I never really ended up going past that first semester at Hans Eisler. But it was a great place to be for a short period of time.
I can imagine. You know, that's something maybe for everyone that's listening that doesn't know. In Germany, it's quite cool. You don't really have to pay a lot to study there. Like, if you get in, depends on where in Germany. In most places, if you're from a EU country, you pay pretty much nothing. In some places, if you're not from an EU country, you pay a little bit. In Bavaria, where I teach, for example, even if you're not from an EU country, it doesn't matter where in the world you're from. If you pass the entrance exam, you don't pay anything. But you need to learn German. Like, that's the one thing in Germany where they're very persistent. You need to have for bachelor's, a B2 level in German, which, you know, it's not that easy. And compared to English, German is not the easiest language. So that's, I think, a big thing. I've not many people that audition to study with me next year. They're all learning German like crazy. And they're like, oh, those articles, it's horrible. And I'm like, oh, I'm so happy I never had to learn German in the way that, you know, I grew up with it. So I never had to study it, because it's not so easy.
It's definitely not so easy, but you know, but the university offered classes, and I think once you're actually there and in the section, everyone spoke German, and it wasn't too difficult after a while, but it's definitely, it wasn't at the standard where I could understand what was happening in history class.
And especially in the first years in bachelor, there's so many. I mean, that's also important to know, probably, you know, especially if you are at the same time in such a demanding orchestra job. It's, you know, one thing, the time you spend in the orchestra, but preparing all the repertoire, especially at that age, because you want to be prepared in the Berlin Phil. You don't want to sight read. And at the same time, in the first years in bachelor studies, there are a lot of subjects. Yeah, music history, music theory, you know, all these things. And that takes a lot of time. So I think it's very understandable for you to say, okay, you know, well, I'm gonna focus on the playing. Because in the end, the playing is the most important thing. And so you were how old? 17, 18? How old were you when you started?
I was 18 at that point.
Boah. If 18 started in the Berlin Phil.
Yeah. I think I was probably, I thought that I was older than I was, but now in hindsight, it's quite young.
And how was it like, I mean, it's one thing to play in an orchestra and stuff, but to leave your home, go into a quite different country with a different language. I mean, Berlin as an 18-year-old, you know, from Australia, how did that feel?
It was definitely a big challenge. And I think just the culture is very different. And obviously Berlin, it's a big city. And I think the thing I found the hardest was the winter. Yeah. The day I arrived, it was February. And it was like, I think minus 20. It was one of the coldest days of the year. And I was not prepared. I was at the train station and like I had like an Australian coat. I don't know why I didn't foresee this. Like kind of a raincoat almost with like a jumper. And that, yeah, the winter was a real struggle and I don't think I ever got used to it. And I have to say that's probably one of the biggest reasons why I'm in Australia today.
The winters in Germany.
Oh, yeah. They're so hard.
Yeah. Also, you know, that, but not only the temperature, what I hate the most is, especially the more northern you get, it's this a long time there's barely any sunlight. That's also
in Berlin,
the good thing.
For sure.
yeah or if you go even further to Hamburg, it's a gorgeous city, but damn. But what I love about Berlin, and it would be interesting to see what you think, like culture wise it's so rich. There's everything, not just German culture, but there are all kinds of countries, and food wise or also event wise but for you was more base, or did you also explore Berlin? Because Berlin is like, I think there's Germany and then there's Berlin. It's not Germany, it's Berlin. It's a different continent. It's a different world.
Oh, for sure. And like I was quite surprised when I left Berlin, because I had a contract in the BR in the Bayerischer Rundfunk for a while. And I was so amazed at the sunlight, like you said. There's sun and blue skies. So Berlin was the difficulty. There wasn't much sunlight in the winter. But the culture there, I mean, obviously it's amazing. And yet, like where we lived, there were art galleries everywhere, you know, museums, events. And like my husband, Bernardo, who's a composer, he was really into new music. And the new music scene there was really interesting as well. I definitely made the most of it.
And you met actually for the first time in Berlin.
Well, so actually, we met in Berlin twice, but I didn't remember him. And then when I met him in England one time, he was like, oh, hi, how are you going? And I was like, I don't know. I don't think we've met, you know. So it's actually, quite rude, you know. Yeah, so it was a good start. We were both living in Berlin. But for me, we met in England.
Okay.
Because I have a terrible memory with faces, you know.
Oh, me too. I always feel so sorry. It's I don't want to be offensive to people, but sometimes I'm just, you know, it's my fault, not their fault.
Totally.
But so you were in Berlin for 2 years in the Carian Academy, and then you went to Bavarian Radio Symphony also.
So I was in the academy for 2 years, but I played there, like, you know, as a casual I was going to say Aushilfer, but it's probably not helpful, as a substitute player for like another year and a half. So I was probably playing there almost full time for 3.5 years. And then, And then I did a lot of freelancing. So I was there for another couple of years doing freelancing. And part of that, I had a short contract with the Bavarian Radio, wow. which was really very fun as well.
Yeah, I mean, those are two ridiculously strong orchestras and ridiculously strong bass groups. For me, also Bavarian Radio Symphony, for those who might not know, I mean, the bass group there, okay, now they're changing a lot because a lot of people just retired. But they have some of the best in the world, so it's insane. So you played with those two, with some of the best Germany or the world has to offer, I would say even.
Yeah, I was definitely very fortunate.
And then how long overall did you live in Germany?
So I lived there for about 6 years. Mostly just freelancing and having lessons, even though I wasn't officially in any tertiary, even though I didn't last very long at Hans Eisler, I was still having lessons regularly throughout my time there.
And then what made you go somewhere else? Like, what, did you have a plan? Did you ever think about staying there? Or was it clear, no, I want to go back to Australia or to England? Or what was the plan afterwards?
Well, I'd always thought, I love Australia. I love the lifestyle here, like the quality of living, the weather, a lot of non-musical reasons as well. And I always thought that I would come back to Australia. But there was a point where we decided we'd give it a go, and a job came up. It was a principal job in the orchestra where I am now. And I thought, why not? So I auditioned for the job, and I came here to Brisbane in Australia, which is a city I'd never really been to. I'd been here briefly on a visit. I just really loved it, and the warm weather. And, now I've got a teaching position here at the conservatorium. And so, I'm currently really enjoying living in Australia, but it's not that I didn't want to stay in Germany. I think it was just more, I'm just an Australian girl,
Yeah, and then you won the principal bass job, I mean, that's also a nice thing to get.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously it was my first full-time job, and I was just lucky that it's a really nice place to work.
And how was it for you? I mean, in Germany, I think you probably played tutti in the sessions. What's like for you the biggest difference, first of all, between being tutti bass and principal bass, but also between playing in a German orchestra compared to playing in an Australian orchestra?
Yeah, so I think probably the biggest difference is, this may just be with the German orchestras that I played with, but they probably rely a little less on the conductor. Yeah. The conductor's role is to rehearse and then obviously to shape phrases and to give their artistic input, but not so much to actually dictate where the beat is. As we know, German orchestras are notoriously late. And so as a tutti bass player, I pretty much just followed what my desk partner or the principal was doing. And then when I came, well, firstly, to a new culture, because I hadn't really played in orchestra in Australia at that point, I found that I had to be a little more reliant on the conductor because people really watch the conductor here. I guess the other thing is when you're a principal, you have to be way more decisive and really prepare your parts a little bit better, I guess, because you've got to sometimes just lay down the beat where you think it should be.
Yeah, and you have to write in the bowings quickly. Because I remember, I never had a fixed job for a longer time in orchestra because fortunately, quite quickly, the solo and chamber music stuff developed so much that I would not have had the time. But I still enjoyed often playing in orchestras. But I was always principal bass and as a substitute even, where you sometimes would play more often in orchestra and then I would know the group a bit more. But often I would play there, and don't know anyone, don't know what's their kind of energy. And often I would be like, if I by the second rehearsal hadn't written in every bowing very clearly, then the next desk would come, hey, and write and start making their suggestions. So as I don't know how that is in Australia, but in German, you have to be very decisive, write everything in and do it. Otherwise the other people will become doubtful and try to impose their own ideas on you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think I'm actually not the most decisive person and I'm always open to trying different things. And so when I put in a bowing and someone else says, what about this one? I'll be like, oh, sure, let's give that a go. But I think you kind of learn that it's easier to just make a decision and stick to it. And people appreciate that as well. I think the section appreciate when you're just decisive. And yeah, like you said, just put things in quickly.
Yeah, it's kind of this balance between you don't want to be arrogant and be like, I don't care what you think. But on the other hand, you don't want to be like, oh, you know, why can you just tell me what to do? No, you need to be the principal, but at the same time, be still sensitive to their own ideas. And the playing with the conductor also, that to me is also a huge thing, because it's so different depending on where you are. If you look in Vienna, for example, like if you look how far behind the beat they are, I think that's probably the furthest behind I've ever seen. Like Berlin is one thing. Then you look at like Staatskapelle Dresden, Gewandhaus Leipzig, they're way further behind in the when it comes to playing after the beat. And then Vienna, sometimes the conductor almost gives the new beat for the next bar and they're still in the last. But somehow it works. And that's a miracle. That's their tradition. But also in other orchestras where rhythmically they're closer to the beat, they don't always look so much at the conductor. Like when I played in LSO, it's more about feeling the orchestra. That's something I also had to learn. I thought, you know, okay, I know the German, Austrian orchestras, they do their own thing. I thought the British, they play together with the conductor, but they kind of do, but they don't really look. They kind of try to feel and adjust through that. And I was, you know, we did like Mahler 5 there once, and in the slow movement with all the pizzicatos, I looked and tried to really learn my part by memory so I could know exactly where to look at, and that didn't help at all. And when I stopped looking and just tried to feel the whole energy and the whole orchestra, then it would work fantastically. But I only, fortunately, in the concert, I got that. But in the rehearsals, I was like, oh, God, why is it not working? Where is the... Because that's the difficult part of the bass. We don't play the melodies, but we, rhythmically, we are so... It's almost more like a percussion.
Yeah, exactly. I honestly, I don't know how you... Like, that's incredible that you started as a principal bass, though. I can't imagine that, because when I was playing for many years in the section, you can kind of watch by... I learn by watching, you know? And you're right. Like, I mean, pretty in every orchestra, and look, in this, it's the same all over the world. We don't really watch the conductor as much as they think that we do. but when you're in a section, you can kind of just morph into what everyone else is doing. And it playing in an orchestra like Berlin Phil, and like you said, Vienna Phil's even more extreme. It's if you looked at the conductor for the beat, I mean, you would be playing a solo, basically. You'd be playing on your own. So you have to just figure out how everyone's breathing and how every orchestra is like a different organism, you know, that kind of breathes in its own way. And it's really interesting to slot into that.
You know, I hope this is not going to be too nerdy for the listeners, but actually it was hilarious. Just a few days ago, I played the Adagio from the 10th Symphony of Mahler with a string orchestra group. And the solo cellist was the solo cellist from the Staatskapelle Dresden, which is one of the great orchestras in Germany, one of the best in the world also. And one of the ones that play very late. but not only compared to the conductor, but also their own cues. So the last note is like the piece ends with a boom, where the cellos and the basses are supposed to play one pitch together. And he would, now for those who are not watching, I will also describe it in words, but he would like give the cue, then shake his head a little bit, and then about 2 seconds later, boom, the pitch would actually happen. And everyone was like, what the hell? But it worked. It worked perfectly. It was totally together. And we all were like, how? He shakes his head a little bit and after he gives the cue and then bam, and it's together. And it's ridiculous.
I think I know what you mean, but the more I think about it, when like whether it's someone leading or the conductor giving the impulse, it's exactly that. Like it's an impulse that you internalize and then react to. That's how I see it. So when you try to play together, it's never going to be actually together because it's so vertical. And yes. I think when you're going with a natural impulse and then allowing yourself to kind of gather together and react to that, it's definitely my preference. And I'm really pushing that on the orchestra here. You know, I'm playing later and later. and it's slowly working. But it's very interesting.
That's for me also one thing that would be interesting to talk about, because not only is there like the how you play compared to conductor and so on and so forth, but also that the sound culture, it's so different everywhere. Berlin especially is very specific. I think an incredible sound culture when it comes to the bass. How did that translate to when you then played in Australia? Like, was it very different? Did you adapt a lot? Did they adapt a lot to you? Like, how did that work?
Well, look, it's actually not too bad. My section is pretty much all German bow players. And most of them studied either in Austria, actually in Vienna, or had teachers from Vienna. So the style, it's not that drastically different. I haven't really adapted. I don't think, like, you know, I definitely play how I have always done. And I feel like it works really well. But it's interesting because in a lot of Australian orchestras, there's a real mixed bag of styles, whether it's like a mixed section with French and German bow, or, you know, the American style, the English style, the German style, whatever it might be. In my section, it's fairly cohesive. So it hasn't really been a big adaptation for me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because that was for me very confusing. For example, in LSO, they play mixed. Some people actually play even like they say, okay, we play Haydn symphony, I play French bow, we play a Mahler symphony second half, I do a German bow, and they can actually do that. Like, you know, the great Rinat Ibrahimov used to also, he could also play both. I don't know if he played both in the orchestra, but we have recordings where he plays German bow and it's incredible. I mean, I'm a huge fan. I have to say at this point. And that was one thing. Even though they had the different bow grips, though, they had a very specific sound, no matter what bow grip they used, but a different sound than what I was used to. And that was also quite tricky to adapt to. And now, one thing that was the most tricky for me, that's why I probably pretty much stopped orchestra at some point, is staying in shape solo-wise while playing regularly in an orchestra. For me, I tried, and then when I played more and more in the orchestra, I just saw, wow, that is so, so difficult. And I admire people who can do it, and you seem to do it incredibly well. How is there any trick? Like, what do you do to stay in shape solo-wise so well, besides playing in the orchestra all the time?
So, I mean, thank you. The first thing that I do is have no social life, basically. No, you're totally right. It's such a different way of playing as well. Like, I feel like when you play in orchestra, you use more force, maybe like more bow speed, maybe a less compact sound. Like, there are a lot of different ways that we play.
Yeah, it's a different instrument, kind of.
It is.
No, actually, it also is with the five string. It actually is a different instrument.
And like, for me, that really helps because I play on a different instrument in orchestra and a different instrument at home. And I always have solo strings on my own bass. And I make a big effort to practice my solo playing every day, no matter what. Wow. And it's a really nice way to unwind, actually. I think when you're at work, playing in an orchestra is a lot of fun, but you have very little control over any musical decision.
Yes.
So if I'm a little frustrated at, you know, what the conductor wants or whatever these, you know, the usual, I come home and I just really enjoy playing on my own instrument. And I think it's actually a big motivator. I'm terrified of being, you know, the stereotypical orchestra musician that's kind of grumpy and frustrated. And so I really push myself to not only play solo music regularly, but to also play a lot of different genres of solo music to constantly broaden my horizons.
That's really impressive, because for me, when orchestra playing physically, it's so demanding. And then to say, oh, I still have the energy to really practice solo every day. Wow, that is really impressive. And yeah, like I said earlier, I think it works so well. When I listen to your recordings, I think it's fantastic, especially that you keep this beautiful, clear sound, because that's what I feel like is easy to lose. Because yeah, you use much more bow. You need this cloud that mixes in the orchestra, but for solo you want to project, you want to be clear, and to keep that and to not and also to keep a left hand that's flexible and not too stiff, that can also play in the thumb position.
I don't know about you though, I feel like when you're in orchestra all day, the sound saturation is so much, and when I come home I feel so overstimulated, and so I find it actually makes me want to play more clearly and more kind of bel canto. You know, I want to kind of refresh my ears a little bit.
It's like hygiene. But,
but also, the physical side of it, it can be hard, and it's probably not sustainable when I'm old, but staying in good shape is also important. And I find that when I get sore, it's actually when I do less, because you condition your body with like a certain schedule. So when I'm playing all the time, look, probably if a physio heard this, they might not agree, but it seems to work. I mean, so far, touch wood.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's interesting to say that you actually feel less tired physically if you do the solo playing in addition to the orchestra. Because logically, you would say it's more bass playing. Bass playing is exhausting. But
also, like, I stand when I play solo, and I think that's a big difference because, like, my body is moving differently.
Yeah,
But also, it's funny because we were talking before this interview. My husband wrote me this solo piece. And at that time, I was saying, like, I've got so much orchestra and chamber music. My left hand was a bit tired. And so a lot of what he wrote was harmonics. So, you know, there's always that trick. Just get someone to write you a piece that has a lot of harmonics to take the pressure off.
Oh, but that, you know, in the end, whatever suits your strengths, right? When I program my recitals... You know, I know I certain things I can do well and certain things I really cannot. I will try to not show those things, so I choose my repertoire.
Which of is course, we all do. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
One thing that's also interesting to me, like I have, you know, I've always been teaching a lot of master classes, and now since like 7-8 months, I've had this fixed teaching position where I teach every week, and I felt playing wise that has helped me so ridiculously much. But I can focus on that and freelancing. So, but you play in the orchestra, then you teach, and then you do a lot of solo and chamber music stuff. How did the teaching for you fit in? Like how many students do you have, and how do you manage time-wise?
So I only have 7 students, which for me is...
It's still a lot.
I mean, for me, that's probably maximum at the moment, because I want to give them all the time that they deserve. But I do find it really helpful. And I feel like, because even if I'm not practicing a whole bunch of different solo repertoire, my students are always bringing something new. Like And figuring out how to play all these pieces is really great for my own playing. Like I have a student who's playing the Missy Mazzoli concerto next weekend. And I had never played that. So when I'm teaching that, you know, I'm figuring out all these kind of techniques and all these, you know, all these different tools that you need to play a concerto like that. And I'm exactly like you. I thought when I first started teaching, maybe, you know, it's going to take away from my practice time and like, you know, I'm not going to be playing for those hours, but it really, really helps with how I problem solve. Because when you've got a student, you have to be able to give some sort of insight, like some helpful advice. Yes. And so it forces me to practice better, but also come up with more solutions rather than just, you know, playing things over and over again and getting frustrated.
Yes, that to me was also really, really inspiring in the teaching process, because often people come with a problem and then I try to solve it and give them some exercises or whatever it is. And then I realize, oh, actually, I could do that better also. So maybe I should do the same exercises to improve those same things. Or sometimes with pieces. I don't know how your experience was there, but sometimes I teach a piece like, you know, for with a couple of students, and then at some point, a piece that maybe I've never played before, and then at some point I actually play it. And having taught it before makes me realize, hey, actually now I can kind of play the piece already without actually having ever practiced it or played it, just because I was teaching it.
Yeah, did
something
for sure.
Like that also happened to you?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really lucky that in my class, I have students that are so like inspiring in the way that they seek a lot of different repertoire. And sometimes it's not something I've really heard. And so it's actually really great on a selfish level. It's really great for me because I'm always encountering these new works. And then, you know, if I, like, for example, one of my students played Montag Sonata, and then I thought, oh, I've actually never played that. And when I came to play it, I had a great map of what I wanted to do because I had to kind of learn it for the student.
Yeah, that is one of the really great ones. Yeah,
I watched your video on YouTube. It's amazing. Like, it was, yeah. I can't believe I never played this sonata before, you know?
Oh, first of all, thank you so much about that compliment. That means a lot because I love that sonata. But, you know, I often, like just a week ago, a bit more than a week ago, I played the Mišek E minor sonata for the first time. And
I've never played it either. I've taught it so much, though.
And it's I realized, wow, this is so good. This is, you know, maybe with the bass, we always say, oh, we have limited repertoire, we need to do arrangements, and yeah, we need to, and it's fun, and commission new stuff, but actually we do have really good stuff written for the bass. People just don't know
it. But also the Mišek is awesome. I don't know why I didn't play that as a student, but also the Montag, I really hadn't heard it until quite recently. And then, I mean, you have a recording, Mick Jung has one, Bozsa has one, so there's a few, but a lot of people, like I did a recital 2 weeks ago and I played it and almost everyone in the audience said they'd never heard of it. And then I had a couple of violin friends come up and like you said, they said, oh, I thought bass repertoire was not very good, but that piece is actually like really compelling.
Nice. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. And so great that you're playing recitals and solo concertos. One thing I want to ask you, you know, you was about a year ago or something, you premiered a new bass concerto with your orchestra. How did that happen? I know, you know, from the freelance perspective, one thing is to play well and practice well, but making things happen is not easy. You need to spend a lot of emails, phone calls, all that stuff to actually get people to write for you. I'm right now in contact also with a lot of composers, but also, you know, organizers. It's very time consuming. So how do you manage that? How did that work with your orchestra? Were they open? Did they say, hey, we want you to play a bass concerto? Because it's very rare that people say, hey, we want to program a bass concerto, let's do that.
Well, yeah, absolutely, you're right. I'm so bad at organizing stuff as well. Like I just don't have the time usually or the energy, I suppose, to reach out. But basically, the composer of this concerto, Paul Dean, he wrote my husband Bernardo and me a series of bass duets during lockdown, during COVID. So he wrote one every day for a week, and each of those short duets basically depicted a day in the life of his lockdown. And I performed them and recorded them with a few colleagues, with a few different people. Unfortunately, my husband was injured at the time, so he didn't do the recording then. But they were really quite popular, and you know, a lot of people heard them. And then the artistic director at the orchestra said, well, it would be really amazing to commission him to write you a concerto with the Queensland Symphony Orchestra. And so it was really special, firstly, because Paul is a really close friend of ours. And obviously, I mean, I've known him since I was about 15. He was the director of the academy that we were talking about earlier.
Wow.
When I was there. And so, like, we know each other so well. And also because obviously it's amazing to have a new bass concerto. And so the piece is very, it's very much about our friendship. You know, like there's a movement. The first movement is called The Arrival of the Queen of Tarragindi, which is the suburb I live in. and then, like, there's a lot of inside jokes. Like, there's a one movement where it's called the Big Deal Waltz, because when I met his wife, look, apparently I have a bad sense of humor, and apparently she was like, oh, you must be Phoebe, you know, nice to meet you. And I was like, yeah, I'm not sure if you heard, but I'm kind of a big deal, you know? Just stupid. I'm so embarrassed to say that now, but so he you know, he made all these movements, and we actually did a CD recording of it, which is yet to be released. And so it will be coming out on an album very soon.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But right now,
you need to let me know when, then we can maybe coordinate this.
But yeah, like, it's an amazing piece, and I'm really excited about that and to share it with everyone.
Yeah, it's also technically, it's not that easy, right? There are some passages there.
Look, he's a clarinetist, so, you know, I think the clarinet, the faster stuff works a little easier than on the double bass. So a lot of practice went into learning that, yes.
Awesome. And do you continue, like, are there further plans for new premieres and stuff like that in the future?
Well, at the moment, well, I mean, my husband Bernardo and I just released an EP, playing his music. So my current project, which has just come out last week, is the piece that he wrote me, which is solo bass. So that has been really amazing, obviously working with my husband.
It's so maybe nice to work you with can say, so what is it called so that people can look it up and listen to it actually?
Yeah, so it's called Sepulcro para un Recuerdo, which means tomb for a memory. And it's on Spotify and Apple Music. And it's just an incredibly beautiful piece that I actually, yeah, I'm really excited to share that with everyone because I'm so proud of him for for coming up with something so unique and beautiful. And then on the same album, there's his music, and he's written a lot of music for electric double bass and left hand because he injured his right hand. You know, he used to play, okay. He was playing in the Staatsoper Berlin, and then he had a really bad injury. So he's kind of rebuilt himself. So that's something that's very interesting, especially probably for bass players, because I don't know how that works.
Well, you know, I rebuilding, I unfortunately know quite well too, because a couple of years ago, a few years ago, I had a neurological issues with playing, also with the bow hand.
Oh my God.
For like 2-3 years, I couldn't really play. I found specialists to work with and to rebuild bit by bit. Yeah, I hid it very cleverly on social media and stuff. Yeah. So I know this feeling, and it's especially in the bow, because that's the sound. That's like the nicest part, right? And then losing that is like, oh, it's losing the voice in the end. So I can relate to that.
I can't imagine going through it. Like, you're so right, and I feel like so much of our personality is wrapped up in what we do, and like,
yes,
you know, obviously with us it's our relationship because we met playing together, and yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
How one thing I'm curious though about is, you know, I talk to a lot of musicians who are together with non-musicians, or maybe with musicians. In my case, I'm with a pianist, but being together, two bassists, is the rivalry, was there ever anything complicated, or is it actually just fun and you play together in the orchestra? And
I mean, look, it's definitely a thing, isn't it? And actually quite common. I think bass players tend to somehow gravitate towards each other. I have a lot of friends that are married to bass players. I'm not sure why, but actually I think it Look, I feel like he's just a really good person. And so that makes it very easy.
Even think, though he's a bassist, he's still...
Exactly. But also we have our own interests. Like he's really into contemporary music and that's always been his passion, his main passion. And then I'm a bit of a like Bottesini tragic, which isn't that cool to say out loud. But, we both have our own musical interests and sometimes they overlap. But I think we've always kind of managed to keep that civil.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing. I a lot of people say, oh, I love making music with a lot of people, but with my partner, I can't play together. Because then the energy goes up and then we just cannot do it. But some people, like in my case, I'm lucky I'm with a
pianist. Well, yeah, pianist you play a lot with, yeah. And that's, you do a lot with your partner, don't you?
Yeah, with Sophia, because, she's a great pianist, great musician. So yeah. Actually, it's so hilarious. Like recently my sister told me when I was like 13, 14 and I really got into the bass, I said, if I ever, stay long with one woman, then she has to be a good pianist so I can play all the pieces with her. And I totally forgot about that.
That's the best deal. You're so right. I always said that too, but somehow I ended up with another bass player. So well done.
Although, good composer. That is a big plus as well. So,
He doesn't listen to my requests, though. I'm like, can you make it easy? And he's like, no, sorry. that would be even, But, pianist is very handy, so...
Yeah, but composer also, that's, so we managed. We managed well, I would say. One thing I want to ask, and now we're approaching the end though, but it's, I think, a very important part for me and for my life, but also for the bass scene right now in general. Now we have social media, we have, it has benefits, it has a lot of bad things as well, but the great thing is we can consume bassists playing from all over the world. I can listen to the great American or Australian bassists, but also there are these platforms that offer tutorials, people talking about how to play certain pieces, technique, whatever. And you do a lot of that as well. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of role has that played in your life? The recordings, listening to them, but also producing them. How has that influenced you?
Well, firstly, I agree. I think it's amazing. And when you use social media, obviously, in this way, it's amazing. I know there are definitely downsides to it. But I think for me, being able to listen just at the, tap of your thumb, I guess, being able to listen to, for example, your recordings or everyone else's recordings so easily, and videos and practice videos and progress, it's really inspiring for me, especially since post... I'm not a student anymore. So it's like you get access to all this incredible, like you said, tutorials and video footage, which keeps, personally, it keeps me very inspired. And I guess, so the String Virtuoso, which you've also done videos for, that they reached out to me. And that was the first that I had, the first kind of experience I had with this online learning. And I got a really, got a great, feedback from that. And I found that it was really helpful for a lot of students, perhaps in places where they don't have access to, teachers regularly, especially.
Exactly. And maybe in some parts of Asia or South America and stuff where they just don't have great bases to work with there. It can be such a huge, huge help.
Exactly. And I would have loved that growing up, access that you get through all these different programs. I mean, and then I did a couple of Discover Double Bass courses, which are amazingly produced. And you can go onto the website and see hours and hours of footage from all these different bass players. So I've become very passionate about it. And I feel like I've done so many of them, actually. It wasn't necessarily my intention, but I've been given the opportunity. And it's something that I think is so important, because then everyone has access to learning. No matter where you are. And I've actually watched a lot of other people's online tutorials and courses to kind of get a little bit of an insight into it.
Oh yeah,
and
me
it's
too.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it's so interesting. Like I was watching Joe Conyers' course and I was like, wow, he plays so differently from how, you know, how we play. But it's really cool to get an insight into all the different styles there are.
And you know, often I steal certain ideas for my own playing
for
my own teaching.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. Like, and I'm sure you, like, I've also had people write to me, teachers being like, oh, thanks. I bought your course and now I'm going to steal anything that's helpful for me. Well, that's what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think is so cool with, I feel it's a bit special about the double bass community, because in other instruments, there's often this feeling of competition with each other. Well, and now I'm finally, you know, I didn't do any competitions for a long time, so it's now a different spot for me mentally. But this feeling of bass community, like of us bassists kind of working together to push the bass forward, like working against the rest of the world who say, oh, bass is just an orchestra instrument. And it is, and it's fantastic in the orchestra, but there's so much more. And we kind of, all of us together, and I feel like it's us together. It's not, I want to do my thing and my career and I want to do mine and we compete. No. We kind of, I feel like we try to push each other and support each other. And through that, hopefully in a few decades, we will have the bass be a solo instrument as well as an orchestra instrument. So people are not going to be, that's my highest goal. So people are not going to be like, the bass can play solo. Can you do something like a recital on the bass? Do you have actually a solo concerto for the bass? Does something like that exist? I get these questions all the time. I mean, have you gone to some of those? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I had someone ask me recently, and this is a professional violinist, can you do double stops on the double bass? Like, can you play two strings at once? And I was like, come on. I mean, probably no, but you know, sometimes it's out of gin. But yeah, and you're totally right about the bass community. I mean, it's so different and it really is true. And I think that's why being on social media as a bass player, I found very healthy, because I reach out to so many different bass players, like including you, of course, but also especially amongst the other female bass players around the world, like Mick Jung and Nina De Cesar, and you know, a lot of the other bass players, and everyone's so open to chatting and like everyone's so open to sharing music and ideas, and it's very special.
And I think it can be incredibly inspirational. So because I can honestly say I would most likely not be a bassist if it wasn't for YouTube. If I hadn't seen those recordings when I was a kid, I don't know, I would have done it as a hobby, but I would have never found the passion, the drive that for the instrument and what it can
do. So, and like Eriksson, really, I think he's one of the big ones to thank.
Yeah, he was the first one that really, like, he was the first one I watched his playing for hundreds of hours. One day I will tell him, or maybe I'll send him this.
My husband growing up in Colombia, he said that he basically learnt from Eriksson, because he was the same. He watched so many of his videos and repeat. Actually, I'm playing with Eriksson in a few weeks, so I'll tell him.
Oh, awesome. Yes, please do. And I will definitely try my best to get him for a podcast episode at some point as
yes,
well.
Yes, I would definitely listen to that.
Then I have to do it. Now that's the announcement. And then hopefully by the time we release this, I already have a conversation with him scheduled. That would be the dream. But I also think you are an incredible inspiration for so many bassists. I think especially, you know, for female bassists, it's something I think that's worth mentioning, because it is a huge instrument and people need to get the idea to just start it. You know, I mean, it's one thing to, once you have started, practice and get better. But if there is not even the initial flame there that says, hey, that's something I want to do. She's doing this, so maybe I can do it as well. Or maybe now I want to do it as well. And I think since overall, like compared to violin, there's still so many, the ratio between men and women on the bass, it's you know, I think we can catch up more. And I think you are inspiring so many bassists, but also, you know, not just female bassists. You inspired me a lot, I have to say too, like especially sound wise. Oh, I love this warm, clear, rich sound that you make in your recordings, and often listen to it, I'm like, yeah, I could sound better, you know. So
I'm gonna like record you saying that and just keep that for whenever I'm feeling really low, because that's like coming from you. That is just I'm blushing. That is the biggest compliment. So thank you. You've made my day. But as a you're right. As a female bass player, I mean, growing up, I had access to these YouTube videos, but really not any female bass players. Like, I mean, I'm sure they existed, but I didn't have access to recordings from very many. And so I think it is really important, you know, to put yourself out there. I think, like, I find it really important, and I find it really important to encourage women to play the double bass. And actually in my studio currently, I only have one male student. It's not deliberate. Like, you know, people joke about it. It's not deliberate, of course. I'm happy to teach guys, but you know, there are a lot of young women playing bass, which is, yeah, so awesome.
It's, yeah, and I, you know, in my eyes, everyone should just play the bass. I mean, it's just the best instrument ever, so.
We can just do bass orchestras, bass quartets. I mean, yeah, exactly. What else is there anyway?
Violins. Yeah, I mean, again, a joke. Please don't take me seriously.
We can keep the piano though, because that's really helpful.
We need them, you know, to accompany us.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Well, I know you have to go to a concert, so I think we should end at this point. I just want to say again a huge thank you for taking the time, for being so chill with all the going back and forth with the technical issues, but also just with the messages. I mean, I just wrote you on Instagram if you want to do this, and you were immediately like, yeah, sure, I would love to. And I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate what you do. And yeah, we will, as part of this, also try to show a lot of videos of your playing, so people can actually watch or listen to what you do and how you sound and how you play. And yeah, I hope everyone enjoys listening to this. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope at some point soon we get to also meet, not via Zoom, but in person somewhere in the world.
Oh, yes. Wait, that's always the best part, right? Like, firstly, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's so amazing, and it's just so cool to have a reason to talk to you, and I've really enjoyed chatting to you. And I hope that hopefully we can meet in person, maybe at some sort of double bass convention in the future.
Yes.
It's always funny though when you meet someone, like, for example, I met Jason Heath, of course, online and like over the internet, and then when you meet in person, it's like you already know each other. So I look
absolutely
forward to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we do another episode then, but in person, and then we see that.
Yeah, that would be great.
See how it feels. But yeah, thanks again, and yeah, I will stop the recording now. But and I wish you good luck also on the concert.
Oh, thank you so much.